direct from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
The housing market's wobbly legs. I'm Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
The spring home selling season is not exactly off to a flying start, but there is some good news. We'll explain it.
Some parents have turned to using life insurance to save for college. You'll hear about the risks involved with this strategy.
On a related note, the great jobs available for those without a bachelor's or advanced degree.
And the new apps for cycling enthusiasts.
Well, we looked at a bunch, actually, ranging from, you know, just mobile apps like Strava, which tracks athletes, you know, while they're riding on their bikes or running, to, you know, really, really far out things like a helmet that has a built-in heart rate monitor that looks at the blood flow through your forehead.
How about that? Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Albergati on tech trends for riders. He's here later in the hour. Well, the housing market is still a work in progress with the spring selling season off to a rough start, but here's some good news. Wall Street Journal reporter Connor Daugherty says the problem that got us here in the first place, you know, the waves of foreclosures that decimated prices and neighborhoods, is steadily fading into the rearview mirror. Connor, how so?
So, the housing market is still a work in progress for the country, but the foreclosure problem is really starting to fade into the rearview mirror. That doesn't mean we're completely recovered in housing or anything. It just means that we've really turned the corner on the foreclosure mess. I think the analogy I used in the story is we have a boat that has water in it, but it has stopped taking on water, and you know, we still have to bail it out. And the statistics in the report that I wrote about today that point to that are specifically new foreclosures. If you look at new foreclosures, kind of, you know, foreclosures that were initiated in this quarter, the level is right about where it was in 2006 and really is right around the long-term average. We have to remember that, you know, there's always some number of people in foreclosure, just not as many as there were during the recession and kind of real estate bust.
And while things are looking much better nationally, the foreclosure problem in individual states is a bit more uneven, right?
Yeah, so one of the themes that's come up through the past 3 or 4 years is that states where you have a judicial process, i.e. you need a judge to foreclose on a home, have taken a lot longer to get through things than states that don't. So interestingly, California, Arizona, those are two states where, you know, they really had a tough time with the foreclosure mess, but they're pretty much back to normal now. It just got worked through really fast. Other states, like New Jersey and Florida notably, have taken forever, and they still have very high levels of foreclosures, largely because it takes a long time to process them. Now, I should sort of say, you know, there's kind of, you know, it's almost like the question of society, which is, you know, what responsibility do you have to kind of move on and what responsibility do you have to kind of protect the homeowner? I would say that the judicial states are, for the most part, that the homeowner protections are a little bit stronger, and that's why it takes, you know, to process them. On the other hand, it's another reason why they are kind of continue to be the laggards.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Connor Daugherty in Washington. And with foreclosure rates this low, some people might wonder why the housing market recovery hasn't been stronger.
Yeah. What you just pointed at is something that we've seen kind of throughout the economy. Let's look at unemployment. The number of claims for unemployment insurance, which is sort of a proxy for firing, if you will, has trended quite low recently, but hiring until last month wasn't all that strong, and it still remains at a 200,000 or so pace over the past several months. You know, and I think the same kind of analogy plays out in the housing market. We aren't seeing new housing problems, but that's a lot different from saying we're seeing lots of people buy new homes and existing homes and stuff like that. To some extent, foreclosures are a reflection of how bad things are. And I would say things aren't getting worse. That doesn't mean the housing market's prospering.
Thanks, Connor. Wall Street Journal reporter Connor Daugherty. So the boat has water in it, but it's not taking on any more water. Good analogy. 11 minutes after the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. You know, we often hear about mental health issues from the perspective of people diagnosed with them, right? We don't often hear about how the caregivers are affected. A new study examines schizophrenia from the caregiver's point of view. Mental health advocate Randy Kay is with us now. Her son was diagnosed with schizophrenia about a dozen years ago. Randy, tell us about him and your situation.
Well, my son is 32 now, and he's lived half his life with schizophrenia, only for several years we just didn't know what it was. Starting about mid-teens, which is fairly typical, he began to exhibit some strange behaviors, not unusual for teenagers, but they got worse. And eventually, after a lot of chaos and searching and trying to get help, we received a diagnosis when he was about 20 or 21 of schizophrenia. That is both a relief and completely devastating, as you might imagine. It's a relief because you have an answer, you know what's been going on. It's devastating because someone you love has a major mental illness, and you learn quickly that when schizophrenia happens, it happens to the whole family.
Right. So what had you raising questions, I guess, in your early 20s? Because as you said, there were some strange behaviors, not unusual for teenagers, as many of us know. But what... I don't know. At what point did you say, you know what, this needs further diagnosis? We're not making progress here.
Yeah, families go through a stage where they just try to fix it. They normalize. If only we get therapy. We tried therapy. We tried a lot of different things. But when behaviors become things like your child is wandering all night in his bathrobe on the street and telling you that God has given him the secret to life, that's like, oh, that's a big, big wake-up call. Yeah. And getting help meant that we needed to understand where all of this was coming from.
All right. So you said he was diagnosed late teens. Is that typical, or might it be caught earlier? Could it happen later? Explain what the teens represent, I guess, for you.
Here's what I've understood, because I did what I always suggest caregivers do, which is reach out for support and education. If you don't understand what's happening, you can't be helpful. And in fact, a recent survey shows that a lot of caregivers feel unsupported, as well as the physical and emotional burden of caring for somebody with schizophrenia. So one of the things I learned was about the onset of schizophrenia, and particularly to answer your question here, there are many ways that it can come on. There's childhood schizophrenia, there's sudden onset in the 20s. In my son's case, fairly typical for males, that it's a gradual onset starting in the teens when the brain is changing. See what I learned by reaching out for resources. And it may take a few years for the symptoms of hallucinations and psychosis to bloom, or you can get a definite diagnosis.
We're speaking with Randy Kay, mental health advocate. We're talking about her son's diagnosis with schizophrenia. Well, obviously, this has had a huge impact on the family. Tell us about the caregiver's perspective here.
As I said, you know, my son lives with schizophrenia. We live with schizophrenia. Somebody that we love has a major mental illness, and it's part of our job to know when to step in, when to let go, to allow him to have his journey, but be a support along the way. So for us, and as the survey shows, we share these feelings with a lot of families. There's that physical burden of making sure he gets to the doctor, making sure he gets his treatment, making sure he gets to work, and managing the stress in his life, but also allowing him to have his life. As the survey corroborates, there's an emotional burden as well of just the fear and the worry. 97% of caregivers of those with schizophrenia worry constantly about their loved one because you just never know what will happen. But with treatment, there is hope. But 94% try to have a positive outlook. And the thing that we need most of all to have that positive outlook is support and resources. And that is what made a huge difference for us. We reached out, and now there's a new website that you can go to called WeLiveWithSZ.com, because as I said, we live with schizophrenia. It's not just my son. And there you can get resources and support. And people can also read my book, Ben Behind His Voices, One Family's Journey from the Chaos of Schizophrenia to Hope. I spoke out about it so other caregivers will know they're not alone.
Thanks, Randy. Randy Kay, mental health advocate. WeLiveWithSZ.com if you want to find information from her and that group. It is 19 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Time now for Gina Cervetti.
New home construction grew last month at the fastest pace in 5 months, up by about 13%. But the all-important single-family home construction nudged only slightly higher, only up by about 1%. This next week, the monthly reports on home sales will grab our attention. Wells Fargo's Gary Thayer says he expects to hear that sales of both new and previously owned properties were stronger in April.
Obviously, the winter months were a weak period for housing, with the bad weather keeping a lot of people out of the housing market. We're expecting to see some modest increases.
Our consumer prices rose by 0.3% in April as we paid more for food, energy, medical care, and housing. Meanwhile, in the latest week, jobless claims fell to below 300,000.
We have finally hit our lowest level in 7 years. We finally dipped under that 300,000 number that always seems impossible to get below.
Joe Doe is with The Street. These days, about a third of our employers expect workers to stay with the company for a relatively short period of time. Career Builders' Jennifer Grass explains.
Today, workers, especially younger generations, change jobs every few years or more often. You know, so they're gaining experience, they're building up skill sets, they're using this as a stepping stone to land a different job, a higher title, higher pay somewhere else.
But she says employers will check the resume carefully and still tend to lean toward candidates who show a pattern of staying with jobs longer. Minnesota has enacted what is believed to be the nation's first law requiring smartphones and tablets sold in that state to come with a so-called kill switch feature as a way to deter theft. The measure takes full effect in July of next year. Another weekend for horse racing lovers with the Preakness Stakes, the second leg of the Triple Crown in Baltimore. California Chrome won the Derby. And you don't want to be number one on this list. Top 10 cities for dog attacks on postal workers. Houston comes in at number one with 63 last year. That's followed by Los Angeles at 61 and then Cleveland at 58. Dog attacks on postal workers.
Speaking of dog attacks, did you see that video?
Oh,
the cat that chased away the dog from that kid?
Yes, I did.
Is that like the video of the week or what?
Yeah, that one's getting a lot of attention online. Boy, that's scary to watch.
That kid took a couple of holes in his leg, too,
yeah,
from the dog's
teeth.
But I've never seen a cat do that before. I know mine wouldn't get off the couch to do it. I'm pretty sure. Pretty sure. Thank you, Gina. 22 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Some parents are using life insurance to help save for college, but they should know that they may be taking on more risk than they realize. Wall Street Journal reporter Anna Maria Andriotis says while insurance policies offer benefits that can't be found in traditional college savings plans, they come at a high cost, and the returns they promise could take years to materialize. Anna Maria, what's this all about?
We finally have a glimpse into how families are using these plans to pay for college. So the investment component of this plan, the funds in that investment vehicle can be used for pretty much anything that the policyholder would like to put them towards. It can be to help pay for retirement costs. It can be to go buy a car, but it can also be for college expenses. And since the recession, there were many, many insurers really started marketing the usage of these types of policies to help parents pay for college costs. It's something that we've seen happening really in the past 4 or so years. Now, there were never really any numbers that gave an indication of our families actually doing this. But this month, Sallie Mae came out with some data that takes a look at, that actually puts some numbers on what appears to be a fairly significant trend. So what we know at this point is that 19% of parents saving for college are planning to use these permanent life insurance policies to help pay for tuition costs. 12% have bought life insurance on their children for the same purpose. What's really interesting about these numbers is that they compete with the number of families that are using 529 plans that have been specifically created to help save for college.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Anna Maria Andriotis. If you do use funds from your insurance policy for college tuition, do you then have to repay those funds later? Are there taxes or penalties here, or is this free to use as you wish?
It's a complicated question. The pitch sounds a lot more appealing than the reality that many policyholders will encounter. For the most part, if you're going to make a withdrawal and if you're going to take out funds from this investment part of the policy, you will have to return that money into the plan. Otherwise, the death benefit that your family receives when you pass away will be less than you intended. Essentially, the amount that you've taken out in a loan, for instance, from a policy, that's how a lot of these withdrawals are taken as loans, that outstanding amount amount would be deducted from the intended death benefit that you had for your family. So that's one big risk if you don't pay back that loan. The other problem with this PIT is that essentially the families that do sign up for these policies are going to find that they are paying very large premiums, and that most, if not all, of those premiums that they're paying in the first few years of the policy actually go towards commissions. They don't really help you out. They don't really help you build much of a, you know, cash balance in that investment vehicle. So for instance, let's take a look at what whole life policies charge. So if you were to compare the premium that a 40-year-old male who's earning $200,000 a year would pay on a term, a 30-year term policy, these are the types of policies that financial advisors have for the most part always recommended, because they are simple life insurance policies that are only providing a death benefit.
Thanks, Anna Maria. Wall Street Journal reporter Anna Maria Andriotis, who's based in New York. 30 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. Coming up next, the post-prison life for ex-cons.
You just watched the market close in Shanghai. New York doesn't open for a couple of hours, so there's time to fit in a session at the gym, squeeze in a haircut, go hit a few balls at the driving range, shoot off some emails, and maybe even breakfast across town. And you'll still be the first one in the office. You're always ready to go the extra mile. Fortunately, so is your Cadillac. With Cadillac Certified Service, our experts make sure your Cadillac is as ready to go as you are.
For a limited time, get a $100 mail-in rebate debit card on a set of four select brand-name tires at your Cadillac dealer. See participating dealer for eligible tire brands and details. Rebate form must be postmarked by June 30th, 2014. Allow 6 to 8 weeks for delivery of debit card. Offer ends May 31st, 2014.
Powered by the most trusted name in journalism, you're listening to the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal sitting alongside Gina Cervetti. And coming up this half hour, new technology for cyclists. Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Albregati has been on a testing mission. He reports back in about 6 minutes. As crime rates across the country have declined and many of the most notorious housing projects have been torn down, an increased focus is being put on the buildup of prison populations and how the barriers ex-cons face upon release may feed high rates of unemployment, homelessness, and recidivism. More now from Wall Street Journal reporter Mark Peters, who's been looking at this. Mark, give us a brief history.
Since as far back as the late 80s, early 90s, housing authorities across the country have had various rules that have prevented ex-offenders from coming and living in public housing. It was part of a tough-on-crime movement, and it came at a time when public housing authorities were in really tough shape. But here we are 20 years later, and Chicago, Los Angeles, New York City, and New Orleans particularly are rethinking these policies because there's some concern that because of their broad nature, they may be having some unintended consequences for a population that has high rates of homelessness, high rates of recidivism, and high rates of joblessness. I think part of what's behind these really early pilot programs, and they're very small, is to try to get at that concern or that challenge where you have people coming out of prison who often don't have many skills, often are struggling particularly with a slow recovery in finding work, and then at the same time, they're thrown into a housing market that's can often be costly in a lot of major cities.
Do you think this might add to ex-cons going back to crime, Mark?
I think housing advocates and those who work with inmates coming out of prison make the argument that without having kind of a basic one of the basic human needs, housing, it can cause kind of a variety of problems. And leave those who are trying to make stable lives very unstable. And also there's concerns that it, particularly if you are an ex-offender and you're homeless, you're more likely to have contact with police. You're more likely to be caught doing things like drinking that people do in their homes out on the street and end up back in the court system.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Mark Peters. What do opponents of this say?
I mean, say public safety is a big concern in this debate, and the idea in that when you talk with folks that is a clear concern in some of these cities, and housing advocates are responding that maybe these policies over the years have been too broad, and if you think about the ex-offender population in a more nuanced way, you can both continue to achieve public safety goals without barring as many people as maybe are being barred now. But there's a clear concern. I mean, public housing, when these policies went into place, was in a very bad place. There was a lot of high-rise housing projects that were really tough places to live and had very high crime rates. And also, the U.S. was kind of toward the tail end of a crack epidemic. So there are these concerns that things could backslide, and that's being talked about and is part of the conversation, and probably why a lot of these programs, like in New York City and Chicago and Los Angeles, are starting very small and are putting in place screening processes and various other checks to ensure that public safety maybe doesn't slip. But that's the open question and the big thing we'll be watching in the years ahead.
Thanks, Mark. Wall Street Journal reporter Mark Peters. It is 21 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Cyclists have used speedometers, heart rate monitors, and other gadgets for years, but they've been difficult to set up and use. Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Albergati has been testing new apps and wireless gadgets that leverage Bluetooth and smartphones for a smoother ride. Reed, what kind of tech did you look at?
Well, we looked at a bunch, actually, ranging from, you know, just mobile apps like Strava, which tracks athletes, you know, while they're riding on their bikes or running, to, you know, really, really far out things like a helmet that has a built-in heart rate monitor that looks at the blood flow through your forehead. There were a bunch of things. Some of them were really, you know, really kind of made life simpler on the bike, made it a better experience, and other things actually sort of complicated it and, you know, took my eyes off the road.
So what would fall in the made things better category?
Well, you know, I really liked the heart rate helmet because, you know, strapping on a heart rate monitor around your chest is something you have to remember to put on. You're always going to put your helmet on before a bike ride, so, you know, it's combining that. The other thing that was a little more for the advanced cyclist was a stages power meter. A power meter tells you, you know, how much work you're doing on the bike. It's really the best way to gauge your performance. So if you're a fitness rider, they're great, but they're also really expensive. The stages one, which is built into a crank arm that can just replace the existing crank arm on your bike, the one I tested cost $800. Now that sounds like that is a lot of money, but it's actually just a fraction of what these things cost before, and it runs on Bluetooth, so it just goes right through your phone and tells your not just your power but also your RPMs, your cadence on the bike. So just with those two items, which actually doesn't add any extra equipment onto the bike, I can get a lot of information about, you know, what I'm doing while I'm riding.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Albergati. And what made things worse by becoming a distraction?
Well, there was one that I thought was very cool in concept, the 4Eye Climb. It's a head-worn display. And this thing fastens to your sunglasses. And just like if you can picture a Google Glass with the little monitor in front of you, this thing has a rubber piece that sticks out and has LEDs on it. It's also got a speaker that plays into your ear. And the cool thing about it is it'll tell you that the LEDs tell you where you are in your, you know, heart rate, where your zones are. But the speaker will tell you how you're doing compared to other athletes on Strava. So it'll, you know, act like a coach telling you, you know, go faster. You've got to beat so-and-so up the hill climb.
And how is GPS utilized here?
Actually, a lot of these have GPS technology. Some of them, like the Garmin Edge 1000 computer, which is just out, $700 actually, is just a full-blown, you know, GPS unit that can give you turn-by-turn directions along a custom cycling route. And it also comes with some really nifty sensors, a speedometer that's just a piece of rubber that attaches to the wheel hub. There's no magnet or anything required. Very cool piece of technology, but also a lot of features, pretty complicated to use. I had to go through some serious troubleshooting to get it to sync up with, you know, my phone and Wi-Fi, which you need to do so that it, you know, uploads your data. So that one has GPS, and some of them just use your phone's GPS. There's a device from Wahoo Fitness called the Reflect Monitor, which actually just acts as an extra screen for your iPhone, which presumably you'd throw in your pocket, and the Reflect goes on the handlebars and tells you kind of the information that you want to know while you're riding your bike.
Thanks, Reed. Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Albergati. Sounds like some cool stuff. 14 minutes now before the hour. 11 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Once again, here's Gina Cervetti.
Well, this next week brings the latest index of leading economic indicators, and Wells Fargo's Gary Thayer says that report from the Conference Board is expected to show that the economy is improving following a very weak first quarter.
We think for the first half of the year it's going to look on the soft side, but for the year as a whole, we're expecting to see economic growth somewhat similar to what we saw last year, around the 2.5% to 3% level.
Encouraging news for preservationists and preservation-minded communities. A new study by the National Trust for Historic Preservation finds that neighborhoods with a mix of older, smaller buildings make for a more vibrant community and more walkable, too. Study looked at Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Seattle. So you don't have a bachelor's degree or an advanced degree. Well, there are still great job options, says Tony Lee with CareerCast.
They range from jobs like appliance repair and auto body repair, the kinds of things you traditionally think of, to jobs like web developer and skincare specialist and paralegal.
Dental hygienist and respiratory therapist are also among jobs in which four-year degrees are not required, says Lee. When it comes to brand names, many of us have given up in favor of store brands, according to a new survey from Deloitte. Rich Nanda has more.
9 out of 10 consumers have told us that they found several store brands that are equally as good as the national brands that they're used to buying.
31% of brands were considered must-haves, ones that shoppers would buy whether or not they were on sale. All right, you encounter a rude store clerk. Do you drop the items you'd planned to purchase and leave, or pull out the credit card? You may be surprised to hear about some new research showing that consumers may be more motivated to buy a luxury item when they're actually snubbed by the sales clerk.
Customers who really aspired to own that luxury handbag or luxury shirt insisted on buying something to meet the challenge and show that, yes, I do belong in this store. In fact, look, here, I'm taking out my credit card and I'm buying something.
The Journal's Brenda Cronin says the same reaction did not happen in stores with lower-priced items. In that case, the response to the rude clerk was, well, I'll show you, I'm out of here. Some weird psychology going on there, huh?
I know. I think when I was younger, I might have done that. But as I've gotten older, there's a different edge you get, right, when you're protecting your money or your reputation or whatever. I'm more likely to go to the counter and say, hey, can I get the rude clerk discount as, you know, I'm about to purchase it? You know, just something like that.
Oh, boy.
I would not be of that mindset anymore about doing it to prove something. Thanks, Gina. 8 minutes now in front of the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Whether you cook outside year-round or just start dusting off the grill this time of year, you got to be up to date on the latest barbecue trends. Did you know that May is National Barbecue Month? Kind of makes sense, I guess, when you think about it. Celebrity chef George Duran from the Food Network show Ham on the Street is with us for some clever ideas. George, what do you recommend?
You know, often people go for the steak and the burger. Well, you want to go with a little bit, you know, more interesting. I like to start with hors d'oeuvres on my grill, and what I make is something like grilled chicken tops, which are literally grilled chicken meatballs. I throw on the grill, and while that's grilling, you want to make like a satay-style peanut butter sauce. So you put peanut butter, fish sauce, coconut milk, lime. You mix that all together, you get a nice creamy, savory sauce that you serve with those little meatballs that you've already grilled with a little toothpick in there, and you can serve those. You want to get people's appetites rolling. Another thing I'm seeing right now that are really big, and kids love them too, are spiral hot dogs. You take a hot dog, you throw it on a skewer, and then you kind of cut it at an angle from bottom to top, and when you pull it out, they become like these slinkies, these kind of spiral hot dogs. Throw that on the grill. It'll crisp up. I like using Hebrew National because they're all beef, and that really gets it nice and crispy. You throw it on the hot dog, and what happens is the condiments get held in there much better, and the kids just love it. It's just so much fun to look at the kids' faces when they see these spiral hot dogs.
Tell me about this grilled watermelon you've got going.
Grilled watermelon is huge right now. I mean, you may not have heard of it, but grilling watermelon really caramelizes the sugars on the watermelon. You get these really great grill marks on it, too. You can serve it the way it is, or what I like to do is I actually cut it up, I dice them up, and I throw it with, let's say, diced tons of tomatoes, a little feta cheese. You can throw a little mint or basil in there, and you turn it into this grilled watermelon salad. The feta cheese and the tomatoes and the watermelon really combine well, and it's such a surprise to a lot of guests. It's a vegetarian option, and it's very, very delicious.
Well, we're speaking with celebrity chef George Duran. You know him from Ham on the Streets, the program on the Food Network. We're talking about 2014 grilling trends. How about techniques? I'm one of those guys. I tend to stick to the basics. I'm not all that great in the kitchen or around the grill, but I don't know. What can I talk about to improve my street cred?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people just end up buying all these gadgets. It's totally unnecessary to go overboard with the grilling gadgets. You have a lot of stuff already at home, like a muffin tin pan, those classic muffin pans that you have at home.
Yeah.
I fill them up with condiments inside of it, ketchup, mustard, sauerkraut, relish, whatever you want. Keep it in the fridge, and when the guests arrive, grill your dogs and your burgers or whatever you want. Pull out that condiment tray, which is the muffin pan, and let them serve themselves. Let them do it themselves. It's all organized. It's really cute. Have little spoons out. And they can pretty much serve it themselves.
Furiously taking notes here, celebrity chef George Duran from the Food Network program Ham on the Street. For Gina Cervetti, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.